The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter. And the first issue that I'm going to read from is the July 2024 issue. And the first article is entitled, A Personalized Program to Heal Your Heart. Cardiac rehabilitation helps people feel better and live longer. Find out if you qualify and what to expect. Every year, more than a million people in the United States enter the turbulent waters of recovery after having a heart attack, heart surgery, or other cardiovascular-related problem, according to an article in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this year. But only about 25% of these people participate in cardiovascular rehabilitation, a personalized program of supervised exercise and heart-healthy lifestyle coaching. Doing cardiac rehab does not guarantee that you'll sail smoothly through your recovery, but it can steer you in the right direction and provide lasting benefits. Cardiac rehab lowers your risk of future heart-related illness and hospitalization and may help you to live longer, says Dr. Hicham Scali, director of the cardiac rehab program at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. By helping you safely regain your stamina, rehab can also make it easier to do things like carry groceries, climb stairs, and resume your favorite activities. The program may even boost your mood by lessening stress and depression. The typical program lasts 12 weeks, meeting twice a week for 1 to 2 hours. A team of doctors and other experts assess participants' health needs and develop individualized treatment plans that focus on exercise, a heart-healthy diet, weight control, stress reduction, sleep, and medication adherence. To find out if you're a candidate, there's another article called Am I Eligible for Cardiac Rehab? Here, two recent graduates of the Brigham and Women's Cardiac Rehab Program in Foxborough, Massachusetts, share their experiences and what they found worthwhile. And the first heading is Kevin's Story. Kevin, 76, had a procedure to replace his narrowed aortic valve and receive a pacemaker. He found all the program's central aspects, nutrition, exercise, and stress reduction, to be very helpful. I had a general awareness that I needed to improve my diet, but I didn't appreciate the combined impact of all the small changes we learned about. I'm now much more conscious about how much salt I'm eating. Like many Americans, I tend to eat lunch meat and burgers. Now I eat more seafood, and I have salads with olive oil vinaigrette. His tastes have changed, and his modified diet feels like the new normal. As someone who typically spent hours working in his garden every day, Kevin looked forward to resuming his active lifestyle. But as is true for many cardiac patients, he wasn't entirely comfortable starting to exercise again after his procedure. You're not sure how far to push yourself at first, he says, but the rehab experience eased his mind. You start with a stress test, exercising on a treadmill or stationary bike while being closely monitored. They help you find the right level of intensity. Keep you in the right range and help you gradually increase as you get stronger each week, says Kevin. He was already familiar with stress management strategies from his career in business education and had even tried one technique with his spirited, high-energy young grandson. I told him if he could be like a Buddhist monk and sit still with his eyes closed for a full minute, I'd give him a prize, Kevin says. He found that revisiting these mind-calming practices for himself was beneficial. Pausing and putting aside thoughts of all the things you needed to do, even for just a few minutes, reminds you that you have the ability to feel more relaxed and less anxious at any time, in any place, he says. Next is Suzanne's story. After receiving a stent from a heart attack in late 2022, Suzanne underwent triple bypass surgery the following year at age 60. She's never smoked and has never been overweight. Her biggest heart risk is a strong family history of premature cardiovascular disease, which affected both of her parents and several siblings. For her, the supervised exercise classes were the most valuable part of her cardiac rehab experience. I was very cautious about what I could and couldn't do. Being closely monitored gave me confidence, just knowing that things were working properly, she says. To stay active, she takes a long walk in her neighborhood, which includes some hills, every day. The program's nutrition classes were also instructive, improving her awareness of the amounts and types of foods to eat. About a quarter of your plate should be protein-based food. Another quarter should be carbohydrates. The other half should be fruits and vegetables. I was already eating fruits and vegetables, but I added even more and cut back on carbs, she says. She avoids processed foods as much as possible and reads the labels on everything she buys. Packaging can be deceiving, since terms like light or reduced sodium don't necessarily mean a product is low in sodium, she notes. For some people, managing a slew of new medications after a heart-related problem is challenging. Suzanne's only complaint was frequent bruising after she got the stent, which requires taking two anti-clotting medications for a year. Today, she takes a blood pressure drug along with two cholesterol drugs to keep her LDL, bad cholesterol, under 55, a target many cardiologists now recommend for people who have had a heart attack. Like Kevin, she also appreciates the stress management coaching. At the end of class, they would lead us through a short meditation practice, she says. I feel my stress in a physical sense, especially in my upper back. Meditation helps you relax your entire body. For anyone who's resistant about doing cardiac rehab, she recommends it wholeheartedly. You'll definitely walk away with physical, mental, and emotional benefits, says Suzanne. Who is eligible for cardiac rehab? Well, Medicare Part B covers comprehensive cardiac rehab if you have a referral from your doctor and any of the following conditions: a heart attack in the last 12 months, stable angina, coronary artery bypass graft, coronary angioplasty or coronary stent placement, heart valve repair or replacement, heart transplant or heart-lung transplant, and stable congestive heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. The American Association of Cardiovascular and Pulmonary Rehabilitation keeps an online directory of cardiac rehab programs. Now we're going to read the comments from Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. And the first question that he has asked is, my doctor prescribed a new cholesterol medication. When I went to fill the prescription, the pharmacist said this drug requires prior authorization. But even after that, it will cost $350 a month, which I can't afford. What can I do? Unfortunately, this is a very common scenario with several possible explanations. Newer medications nearly always cost more than older ones. For treating high cholesterol, older drugs, including statins like Crestor and Lipitor, as well as ezetimibe or Zetia, all of which have been available for years and inexpensive generic versions, are available. Health insurance companies want to make sure that people have tried the less expensive drugs first, which is reasonable and are recommended by guidelines. To do this, the companies require what is known as prior authorization. Doctors must submit a form that explains the patient's clinical situation to justify the use of the newer drug. Many hospital systems hire pharmacists to do this time-consuming task. Many authorizations are approved, Others are denied due to very restrictive criteria by some insurance companies. Sometimes the reason for the denial isn't clear. However, the federal government recently passed new rules that require more transparency, timeliness, and explanations for prior authorization decisions. These take effect in 2025. Your drug cost might be high for other reasons related to our complicated health insurance system. Many plans have an annual deductible, the amount a person has to pay out of pocket for tests, procedures, and medications before insurance kicks in. Early in the year, people may need to pay nearly full price for medications to reach their deductible. After that happens, you pay only a fixed copay, usually $10 to $30. The opposite happens for people on Medicare. At the end of the year, the amount of drug coverage provided might run out, so people have to then pay full price for medications. Most insurance companies have pharmacy benefit managers who negotiate prices with health insurers and pharmacies. They help decide which drugs to cover and how much people pay, but their fees and incentives contribute to what you end up paying. If you ask, your pharmacist may have some sense of why the cost of that particular drug is so high, but often people need to call their insurance company to sort out the underlying reason. One option for some people who need to take expensive medications over a long term is to switch insurance plans. When your current insurance is up for renewal, review other plans and check the copay for various medications you take and choose your plan based on that. Next in the Harvard Heart Letter of July 2024 is an interesting article entitled, Can Intermittent Fasting Improve Heart Health? Fasting, or purposely not eating food, dates back to ancient times when people fasted in hopes of curing a disease or for religious reasons. Today, different forms of fasting remain popular for their possible health benefits, including weight loss and improvement in heart-related risk. A recent review article suggests some potential benefits. But timing isn't everything. You still need to pay attention to the overall quality and quantity of the food you eat. Intermittent fasting includes a range of strategies to limit the timing and frequency of meals. One variation, time-restricted eating, involves eating only during a certain time window over a single day. For example, you would have food only during the hours of 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then eat nothing during the other 16 hours. Alternatively, a person can try alternate day fasting, fasting or significantly limiting calories for a full day. You choose certain days during the week when you eat nothing, or limit yourself to just 400 to 600 calories. On the other days of the week, you follow your normal eating pattern. In one popular version, the 5-2 diet, you eat normally on 5 days but restrict your calories on 2 non-consecutive days. With alternate day fasting, you eat a calorie-restricted diet every other day. Generally speaking, intermittent fasting has a good safety profile, says Dr. Armin Yerevanian, an endocrinologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. People with diabetes who rely on insulin and certain medications to lower the blood sugar levels need to be cautious. For them, fasting isn't dangerous, but it requires careful planning with their doctor to minimize the risk of low blood sugar. Intermittent fasting probably helps improve cholesterol levels and other heart risk factors because the practice promotes weight loss. Because of time restrictions, you naturally tend to eat fewer calories, especially if you shut down a habit of late-night binge eating. Plus, when you don't eat for extended periods of time, your body switches fuels away from carbohydrates and starts burning fat. The biggest issue with intermittent fasting is it can be challenging to maintain over the long run, says Dr. Yerevanian. Most studies of the practice have lasted only 12 to 16 weeks. Some have gone up to 6 months. It's easier to stick to a diet when you're being closely watched as part of a study, he says. But in the real world, it's often hard to follow a strict eating schedule when you're also juggling various work, family, and social commitments. The times that I've seen time-restricted eating be most successful is when people are ready to make a broad set of lifestyle changes to improve their health, says Dr. Yerevanian. Rather than relying solely on intermittent fasting, they use it as a tool to change other aspects of their lifestyle that are affecting their weight and heart risks. Combined with a healthy plant-focused diet, along with regular aerobic and strength-building exercise and routine preventive care, intermittent fasting can be a safe and effective tool to improve your cardiovascular health. And then there's a short article attached, which begins, "One way to assess the effect of a diet or other therapy is to pool the results from many different randomized trials, creating what's known as a meta-analysis. Another version, called an umbrella view, goes one step further by combining results from many different meta-analyses." That's what a team of researchers did with intermittent fasting. Their umbrella review in the April 2024 issue of eClinical Medicine combined results from 23 meta-analyses and reviews of intermittent fasting studies, which included mostly people classified as overweight or obese, and also some with diabetes or metabolic syndrome. The control group varied, but included people on calorie-restricted diets, typical diets for specific cultures, and habitual diets. Researchers found good evidence that intermittent fasting can lower waist circumference, fat mass, triglycerides, LDL and total cholesterol, fasting insulin, and systolic blood pressure. Now, here's a very relevant article from the Harvard Heart Letter of July 2024, and it's entitled, "Protect Your Heart During the Dog Days of Summer. Hot, hazy, and humid outside? Exercise caution during outdoor activities." During the summer of 2023, record-breaking high temperatures scorched many regions of the United States. Not surprisingly, emergency department visits for health-related illnesses also rose during that time period. According to the CDC, this worrisome trend is expected to continue as climate change ushers in longer, hotter, and more frequent episodes of extreme heat. People who have underlying health problems, especially cardiovascular disease, are more vulnerable to the hazards of high temperature. Air pollution, another threat to the heart, can also pose problems during the summer months. People who have or are at risk for cardiovascular disease should be a bit more cautious exercising outside in hot weather, says Dr. Prashant Rao, a sports cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. When the temperature soars, exercise is more taxing because your heart has to pump extra blood, not only to your muscles, but also to your skin to help radiate away excess heat. But when the air temperature approaches body temperature, around 98 degrees, this process no longer works. Sweating helps cool your body. Heat from your body turns liquid sweat into water vapor. This works well on dry days, but when humidity levels climb above 75%, the water vapor already in the air makes evaporation more difficult. It's still important to exercise during warm weather, but you may need to crank down your intensity a couple of notches, says Dr. Rao. You should avoid outdoor activity during the hottest part of the day. Temperature usually peaks between noon and 3 p.m., so consider doing outdoor exercise in the early morning or early evening, away from traffic-heavy areas. Lightweight, light-colored clothing made from sweat-wicking material will keep you cooler. Drink water throughout the day, but especially when you're active outdoors. Plain water is fine, but if you're exercising in the heat for more than an hour, like a long tennis match or round of golf, sports drinks are a better option. These beverages contain electrolytes, minerals like potassium, sodium, and magnesium, that can be replenished, that can replenish what you lose from sweating. People who take blood pressure medications are more prone to becoming dehydrated in hot weather, so they should be extra careful to drink plenty of water, Dr. Rao says. Sometimes it's simply uncomfortable to even walk outdoors. On those days, consider swimming or doing water aerobics or head to an air-conditioned fitness center. During the summer, high temperatures speed up the chemical reactions that create air pollution. Smog and haze result from a combination of dust, water vapor, and tiny airborne particles from industrial power plants, vehicle emissions, and wildfires. Wildfires, which tend to strike in summer and early fall, are now more frequent due to climate change and play an increasing role in overall air quality. Air pollution contains invisible particles less than 2.5 microns in diameter, so minuscule they aren't trapped by filters in your nose and upper airways. Known as PM2.5, they pass through your lungs into your bloodstream, where they can interact with receptors and trigger nerves that help regulate your heart rate and breathing. These particles spur inflammation, the outpouring of immune system cells and other substances that accelerate atherosclerosis. Even low levels of air pollution appear to increase the risk of heart attack, stroke, and irregular heart rhythm. That's why it's worth keeping tabs on the air quality. Local news outlets sometimes report this information, which is also featured on many weather-based smartphone apps and available from the Environmental Protection Agency at www.airnow.gov. There's still a lot to learn about air pollution's effects on the heart and the best prevention strategies. People should heed the warnings about staying inside if the air quality is poor and be mindful of when and where they exercise, says Dr. Rao. When my primary care provider recently asked me about my exercise routine, I told him I run by Charles River as part of my marathon training. He pointed out that that route is right near a very busy road and that I should avoid running there during rush hour, says Dr. Rao. Now I'm going to read some shorter articles called Research We're Watching, again in the Harvard Heart Letter. In the first short article, sitting less may help lower blood pressure. Older adults might be able to lower their blood pressure by reducing their sitting time by as little as 30 minutes per day. The study includes 283 adults aged 60 to 89 who had a body mass index between 30 and 50. About half received a standing desk and activity tracker, plus 10 health coaching lessons focused on setting goals to reduce sitting time. The other participants received 10 coaching sessions focused on general health unrelated to activity. After 6 months, people in the first group reduced their sitting time by nearly 32 minutes per day. Their systolic blood pressure dropped by an average of 3.5 points. That's nearly as good as the 4-point drop observed in studies examining physical activity as a way to lower blood pressure. Older adults typically sit 65 to 80% of the time they're awake. For those with obesity or other chronic health conditions, sitting less and standing more may be an effective, feasible way to reduce the risk of heart disease. The study was published online in the March 2024 issue of JAMA Network Open. Now here's another interesting article. Spouse's heart disease is linked to higher risk of depression. The spouses of people who have heart attacks, strokes, and heart failure may face an elevated risk of depression, according to a study published online in the April 2024 issue of JAMA Network Open. Using data from a Japanese Health Insurance Association, researchers identified 140,000 married couples in which one person had a cardiovascular-related problem. Most were men with an average age of 58. They then compared these couples to a control group of similar couples without heart problems. During the follow-up period, which lasted 2.5 years, people whose spouses had cardiovascular disease had a 14% higher risk of being diagnosed with depression. People whose spouses have heart disease often cope with grief as well as caregiving and financial burdens, the study authors noted. Their findings suggest that more attention to and support of them is needed. And also, the article points out that using a web-based app, most people correctly identified their need for cholesterol-lowering statin and took the drug appropriately without a prescription. A study was done on 1,000 adults who used the app, which is based on current guidelines for statin use. Their average LDL cholesterol was about 140. 91% of the participants correctly determined whether they should or shouldn't take a statin, as compared with the doctor's assessment. Most continued on to the six-month treatment phase, and 98% correctly used the recommended drug, a 5-milligram dose of rosuvastatin or Crestor, achieving a 35% drop in their LDL levels. The app is being developed by the drug's maker, AstraZeneca, based on FDA guidance, but it still requires regulatory approval. The goal is to enable people to assess their need for a statin and start the drug without a physician's prescription. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.